Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Artist First World Radio Network, home of the best new music you've never heard, and home of the best new talk shows you need to hear. Please don't forget to visit our archives page at www.artistfirst.com, where you can hear all our past shows for free and on demand. You are tuning into Chit Chat Cafe Live. This show airs every Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. For more information about this show and to listen to past shows for free, please visit artistfirst.com/chitchat.htm. And don't forget to follow Artist First on Twitter. You can find us under the Twitter handle at @artist_first. And now here are your hosts of Chit Chat Cafe Live, Nancy and Lisa.
Hi, everyone. It's Nancy. Time for Chit Chat Cafe Live on Artist First World Radio Network. It's a great time to relax and unwind and enjoy some chit chat. Oh, we're so honored tonight. Our first guest is Jimmy Dillon. He toured and recorded extensively, backing up great artists like Clarence Clemons and Bruce Springsteen, and we've been playing his music all afternoon. Later in the show, we're joined by Pulitzer Prize-nominated journalists Bill Mushi and Bob Dvorak. They're going to discuss their book, Game Over, Jerry Sandusky, Penn State, and the Culture of Silence. Lisa, how are you?
Okay. How are you? Well, you know, I've been a little down today because a girl in my daughter's school, I feel so horrible, she's a senior in high school, 18 years old, was killed in a car accident, tragic car accident, the other night. And I've just been so sad about it, thinking about her family, and it's just awful. I can't even imagine. Can you imagine having to bury your child? It's got to be the worst thing that can happen to a human being, honestly. I feel so sad about it. But
it is very sad, and my prayers go out to her family and to her, and I just am consoled knowing that, you know, she's not missing. I still go back to that, Lisa.
I know. You're more, that would bother you more, her being missing than
Yes. Knowing
where she is dead.
Yes. Oh, but my heart, it goes out to everyone Yeah. There in your community and the high school.
Yeah, it's just awful. Anyway, let's talk about something fun. What product do you have this week?
I have something fun. First of all, I've been very busy teaching, and then, you know, I had my relatives visiting. My little nephew was riding the dirt bike all over our countryside land here in Minnesota. Remembering, everyone, Lisa's in New Jersey, and I'm in Minnesota. So I'm live from the area where I have my exercise equipment at my home, and I'm just laughing before we went live. My product of the week, I've had for a long time. Don't laugh. It's a hula hoop. It's as simple as can be. But, you know, I just put on some fun music, you know, perhaps something by Jimmy Dillon. And just go at the hula hoop. And, of course, when I'm done, I have to do that old trick. Remember when you were a kid, you take your hula hoop and, you know, let it roll forward and snap your wrist as you let it go, and it will roll back to you?
No. I forget.
Well, I still like to do that.
I was a child with a hula hoop.
Yeah, I still like to do that. So funny. It just makes me smile.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. Hey, it's a workout, too, right?
Yeah. What's your product of the week?
Well, since it was hot the other day, it was hot here. It was like 85 degrees. I didn't want to wear stockings. I don't wear stockings, but tights. I didn't want to wear tights, and I wanted to wear a dress. And my legs are really pale white because I, you know, haven't been out in the sun yet. So I tried the Staley. Now it's been out for a couple of years, but I have never been able to find the shade that I need for my legs. I finally found it at Ulta. It's called Sally Hansen Airbrushed Legs.
I've heard of that.
I love it. Oh my God, it's terrific.
And you just spray it right on.
Well, you put it on your hands first. You kind of rub it between your palms and then smooth it on your legs, on your feet, on your legs, you know, and it just gives a nice color. It's not too dark. It doesn't look like, you know, it just you smooth out, you know, even your skin tone. It gives you a little bit of color so you don't look like a ghost. And it comes off when you take a shower. It's fabulous.
That's amazing.
It's hard to find because it's people must have been using it for a couple of years now. It's been out for a couple of years. Again, every time I go to a store, I always look for it because I need the light. They have medium and they have dark. And I could never find the light, but I found it in Ulta the other day. They had one left. I said, I'm buying it.
Well, you know what? You should go around to a few Ultas.
Yeah, well.
You travel for your job.
Well, then I'll start getting, I'll start getting a tan. But for now, it'll last me, I think, through the spring. But it's a great product, everybody. If you need something to cover your legs. Because self-tanner, you have to wait a couple days till you start seeing. This is just like a makeup. It's almost like a makeup for your legs.
How about that? Well, you know what you could do?
I think it was nice.
You could have the spray tan while you do your hula hoop.
Right.
Oh, anyway. Too fun.
Well, we probably should get to our guest.
Can't wait.
Waiting on our phone line here. I'd like to introduce everyone to Jimmy Dillon. He's a guitarist who toured and recorded extensively, backing up great artists like Clarence Clemons and Bruce Springsteen and John Lee Hooker. Welcome, Jimmy.
Oh, thank you very much. How you doing?
Good, good. This is our pleasure. This is quite the honor to have you on our show with us.
Well, thanks very much for inviting me. I appreciate it.
Why don't you start off by giving everybody a little bit of background about your career?
Well, I was born in Los Angeles, but I spent my formative years near Chicago, growing up in Michigan, which is where I learned to play the guitar. So I was influenced by a lot of the stuff coming out of Chicago and Detroit, like John Lee Hooker and the early blues guys, and of course the Beatles and the Stones, coming up in the late 60s and 70s.
Right.
But I moved out to San Francisco when I was 17 and really, really got bit by the whole West Coast bug. At that point, I was seeing bands like Santana and, all the great bands in the Bay Area. So it was very inspiring for me as a young musician coming up. And so I basically, my great love has always been guitar and singing and writing. And so I'm a songwriter, I'm a guitarist, a singer, and I'm also a playwright. Because I wrote a musical about called Ascension of the Blues, which is about the history of American music. So I've always had an interest that goes far beyond just the musical part of it. I love the theater part, and I love teaching. So my whole life is just filled with that kind of stuff. But I played around in bands like many people do in high school and college, and then I was in a band called The Edge in San Francisco for a number of years in the 80s, and it was kind of sounded a little bit like The Police. It was a very cutting-edge, kind of underground reggae ska group and with a lot of good friends. And then I met the big man, Clarence Clemons, who you've mentioned already a couple of times. And we just hit it off in a big way. That was in the late 80s. And I became his musical director and a good friend and his partner. And we toured a lot. And, of course, being with Clarence during those years, everybody loved the big man, as you well know. You're from New Jersey, or at least half of you are. And so touring the world with Clarence, I got a chance, which was a big thrill, to play with people like Bruce, did a bunch of shows with Bruce and Bob Dylan, people like that. So it was sort of a reflected glory, if you will, being with him. And I learned a lot. And then I went out, I did a couple of tours of Europe with Clarence, and I thought to myself, gee, one of my big dreams was to be kind of a roots rock and roll blues guy in Europe. That was always like a big dream of mine. So I went ahead and did that. I took some time off for Clarence and I got a record deal in Europe. And I toured the 90s in Europe. I made 4 CDs with the Robert Cray Band backing me and lived in the south of France and played every gig you can imagine from Prague all the way to London and back.
Wow.
And then came back here and wrote a musical called Ascension of the Blues. And that all led me to where we are today, which is a new album called San Francisco Music Club. And San Francisco Music Club is a band that I'm currently working in with my friend Lauren Rowan and a bunch of great musicians and singers. And we have a new record coming out May 5th, so we're very excited about that. And it's basically 21st century Americana, if you want to, for lack of a better term. It's definitely world music in that there's lots of different styles, sort of like Graceland, recorded part of it in Cuba. But it's all very danceable and very, very rockin'. So I'm real excited about that.
Will you be touring?
Yeah, we will. We're just now getting, doing interviews and getting the record out. But we'll be definitely touring, especially in the West Coast, because we're here in San Francisco, so we'll be doing a lot of dates here. But chances are I'll be back in Michigan because I have a lot of connections there. And who knows, maybe we'll be at the Stone Pony one day.
I just was near the Stone Pony the other day. I drove by it. It was yesterday, actually.
Yeah. Is it still going?
They're really redoing Asbury Park. It's looking real...
Good.
Yeah, they're really giving it a facelift. So I say in a year or so, it's going to be really the rocking place to be.
Great. I'm so glad to hear that.
Yeah.
Well, Jimmy, we're really excited about your new CD, and is it going to be more, with the different genres in mind?
Yes.
Back to the old style.
No, it's definitely fresh, and I've done a lot of extensive traveling, not just musically, but otherwise, living in Europe, living abroad. I've been all through South America, Cuba. In fact, one of the songs we recorded was recorded in Havana, Cuba. You can't tell. It's a secret, because we're not supposed to go down there. But to illustrate where the album is, what the album sounds like, there's some great sort of New Orleans feels in there. There's a song called Four Winds that I mentioned earlier that I wrote that has kind of a really great Neville Brothers feel to it. And then it's also got some sort of Afro-Cuban, kind of like I keep going back to Graceland by Paul Simon. It's got a little bit of that flavor. And then, of course, we have, just like some funky get-down Chicago blues. So it's truly a spin-the-globe kind of project. But ultimately, almost all the songs on the piece make you want to get up and dance. And I think that's one of the things important about it. And there's a lot of great guests on it. We have, some great singers. The musical that I wrote, Ascension of the Blues, that I mentioned earlier, sort of was the inspiration for San Francisco Music Club in many ways, because I got a chance to work with some luminaries in the Bay Area, and also it was basically a musical, and it ran in Chicago and Detroit and out here in San Francisco. And I got the chance to work with a really diverse group of singers, dancers, and performers and musicians. And when we first started working on San Francisco Music Club, I really wanted to leave the door open to include as many different eclectic singers and players that we could along the way. So we have sort of an open door policy. In fact, on May 5th, we have a guy called Jose Neto playing with us, who's the guitarist for Steve Winwood and Eric Clapton when they're on tour. And we actually have this other guy named Norman Greenbaum. Do you remember him? Spirit in the Sky?
Love
that song. It's one of my favorites.
Isn't that wild? He's coming down to play his song at our gig on May 5th at the Sweetwater Music Hall in Mill Valley, California. So we're kind of excited about that.
That's really cool.
Oh, that is great. Well, tell us a little bit about what you're doing now. I hope I'm pronouncing it correctly. Rowan?
Yes, Lauren Rowan is my partner on the San Francisco Music Club. We both sing on and wrote all the songs on the record. And he and I were in a band together called The Edge in the 80s. And we did a lot of writing, a lot of playing, a lot of touring together. And then, as often happens, we went off on our separate careers. He and his brothers, the Rowan brothers, have done a lot of stuff. Lauren's a Grammy Award-winning songwriter and an incredible singer and great guitarist. So he and I have a real simpatico with each other as players. We always have been playing together for more than 25 years. So we really got together and decided, on the San Francisco Music Club project, that it just seemed like a lot of fun and something really colorful and different and fresh. So it's great to have a partner, a comrade in arms, as it were, doing this music together. And then we use a great band, Matt Willis on drums, Eric McCann on bass. He also played with Clarence. And then we have a great horn section, Michael Pelliquin on saxophone and harmonica, and Jeff Lewis on trumpet. And then one of our secret, I call her our secret weapon, is beautiful named Sakai. And
I
she
love
sings
that.
With us both on the record and live. She was on Train's last album. She's on this Save Me San Francisco, and has sang with Stevie Wonder, Narda Michael Walden, Sting. We did a gig with Sting together, she and I. So she's really brings a lot of thrilling vocals to the whole thing. So it's very much a vocal band. A lot of great harmonies, but it definitely has the beat as well.
And you all have an impressive history there in Marin.
Yes, in Marin County. We've all been around here for a while. Lauren came out here from Boston. I came out, as I mentioned, from Michigan. Sakai is a local gal, but we've all worked with different people over the years. I've backed up Bob Dylan and obviously the Boss, who that already about me. But we've all worked with different people. Lauren worked with Jerry Garcia from the Grateful Dead back in the 70s.
Wow. Cool.
And he was kind of... So we've all had our brushes with greatness, but most importantly, we love playing together, and we love just having those magical moments on stage where you can really bring it. And the recording process is good as well. It's really been fun. So it's exciting.
Well, and again, the CD is called Love and Freedom.
Yep.
It's available in stores on May 5th. And is it digital on May 22nd?
It's digital on May 22nd, and you can go to our website, which is San Francisco Music Club, four words, .com, and you can see what we're up to there. You can also go to JimmyDylan.com, which is my website, and you can see what I do. I also run a nonprofit kids program that you'd probably love called Blue Star Music Camp.
Because I'm a teacher, and so I'm dying to hear about that Blue Star Music Camp. It's in Michigan and San Francisco, correct?
Yeah. We started in Michigan. It's actually really based in San Francisco now. We've done it in Austin, Texas, and all over the country. But we're really, our home base is now in Marin County. And I love teaching kids. I love working with kids. We give away half our seats and scholarships, so we do a lot of benefits. We're doing I can tell you this now because it's coming up soon. It's kind of top secret, but our newest member of San Francisco Music Club is Dana Carvey. Do you know him? He's a comedian.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, of course.
I love
that. Well, Dana's going to do a show with us here in Mill Valley in June, and we'll be announcing that. And San Francisco Music Club will be his backup band, and it will raise money for our nonprofit music program for kids, Blue Star Music Camp. So we're excited about that. And I also do instructional DVDs with a company called GuitarControl.com. It's actually out of Philadelphia, your neck of the woods. And you can see that on my website. If you have anybody that's interested in learning guitar, kids or adults, you can see it on JimmyDylan.com, that I do worldwide teaching that way as well. So if you're a teacher, you can appreciate that.
I can. Well, I just have to tell you, I don't know anything about guitar, but we have one at our home. My daughter is learning to play.
Mm-hmm.
And just watching some of your information on your website, I was trying to pick it up.
Yeah, you know, I think the key, I don't know, you know this as a teacher, the key for me is to try to keep it simple and also make it really fun for them, for the students. I think that's the key. And if it means, you know, showing them a G chord and a D chord and an A minor and they can play, you know, a cool sing-along song, so be it. I think a lot of people get bogged down with theory and all that. You got to keep it simple. You know that from your teaching. And make it fun. That's my advice there.
I really liked it because I could picture that everyone who already knows or is trying to learn guitar for real, I could picture them thinking, this is great. I'm going to learn the same chords that the boss knows.
Right. Exactly. That's the way I teach. I try to get into the student's head and say, what floats your boat? What do you love? Okay. Rather than this is scales and this is that. There's a place for that, but I think when we teach at Blue Star, we're really about performance and about serving the song and getting kids to, you know, work together as a team. And that's really where the fun starts, I think. So if you're interested in that, I have a lot of DVDs out that I show you all the good stuff.
Were you so close with Clarence when he died?
Oh, yeah. We did a gig together like less than 6 months before he passed away. In fact, Bruce, I spoke to Clarence about a month before he passed away. You know, he was in Jupiter, Florida, where he lived. And we were very, very close. And, you know, he was such a swell guy. One of his parting gestures was he goes, you know, I want to do something for the kids. He always played benefits for us and stuff. So he got Bruce Springsteen, the boss, to sign a guitar for our nonprofit program. And we're going to be auctioning that off when we do our show with Dana Carvey. So how's that for, you know, a big-hearted guy that was one of his parting gestures? So, yes, we were very close right till the end.
Oh, that is wonderful. And on our website, for our listeners, we have your link. And tonight we're also going to put your link for Blue Star Music Camp.
Well, thank you so much. That's really sweet of you to do that. I really appreciate it.
We have a lot of listeners worldwide who like to click on the links and learn more information.
Cool. That's great.
And so what are you working on now?
We're spending most of our time doing exactly what I'm doing right now. We've booked a lot of gigs this summer, both festivals and, as you'll see on our website. But I'm also, I've been putting this off, and my wife keeps telling me I got to do it. I love acoustic guitar and finger picking and that kind of stuff. And I've been writing an acoustic album for the last, couple of years. And I'm going to go in the studio. There's a drummer called Narda Michael Walden, who's a phenomenal drummer. He played, he produced Whitney Houston. You might have seen him on the TV shows that were on about Whitney. But he's got a great studio here, and we work together a lot. So I'm going to go in and just get my acoustic guitars all lined up and just play a whole album live right in the studio, and that'll be my little summertime project.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Well, we would really like to have you back sometime because Lisa and I, we pick different charities to focus on.
Mm-hmm.
It would be fun to focus more on your Blue Star Music Camp.
Well, that would be great. We'd appreciate it because, you know, as you well know, as a nonprofit, we need all the help we can get in any economy. But we reach out to kids from all over the world. We've had kids from Ireland. We've had kids from all over the planet that come in. And basically, all our teachers are touring professionals from around the world, and they share their knowledge to the next generation of performers. So it's really a valuable thing, and it's very boutique. You know, we have like 15 or 16 kids and 5 or 6 teachers. So it's a really special, you know, intimate ratio the way we teach, and they get to do their own show. So it's great.
Well, I saw that on the video.
Yeah.
Lisa, I'm sorry.
No, I said that's great. That's really so nice.
It is.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's great. Well, come back and join us again, Jimmy.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's just been a pleasure talking to you. And,
it's our honor, honestly.
Yeah,
all right, well, we'll catch up down the road and check out our music.
That'd be great. Hey, and this is a great fit because with the links to you and your camp and your music and your website, our worldwide listeners, we have listeners that are in France and Ireland, England, all over the world, India.
Beautiful, beautiful. Well, we'll all be in touch.
Well, thank you, Jimmy. We're going to play another song as we go to commercial break.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Now back to Chit Chat Cafe Live on the Artist First World Radio Network.
Welcome back, everyone. We're going to play more music from Jimmy at the end of the show. So, Lisa, are the flowers blooming in New Jersey?
Yeah. Well, yeah. Mm-hmm. We went
they are here.
We went to hyacinths already, and now we have pansies, and just real pretty. I love this time of year.
I do, too. It's so nice. But the weather's been crazy. The other day.
No, it was like 80 the other day. Now it's cold again. It's like 65. And it's
That's here, too.
Like
but all in one day in Minnesota. And we never get nervous about weather in Minnesota. It's just we're used to it. Is this Bill or Bob?
This is Bob.
Hi, Bob. We're just sitting around chatting. I'm Nancy Barty, and here's Lisa Kocher.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, how are you?
Good.
We're waiting for Bill, and then we're going to talk about your book.
Okay, good, good. How are you ladies doing tonight?
We're wonderful. We're so honored that you can join us.
Thank you for having us on. I appreciate the opportunity to talk about a very serious subject.
I know. And so as soon as Bill comes in, we will be ready to talk about your book.
We've enjoyed reading the book. Thank you very much for sending it to us as a promotional book, and it was just delightful. Is this Bill?
Yes, I'm here.
Hello, Bill. I'm Nancy Barty.
Hi, Nancy.
And here's Lisa Kocher.
Hi, how are you?
Everything's good. How are you guys doing tonight?
Good.
Well, we're going to introduce you and get right to it. Everyone in Chit Chat Cafe Live, we're so honored to have Pulitzer Prize-nominated journalist Bill Mushi and also author Bob Dvorak join us tonight to discuss their book, Game Over, Jerry Sandusky, Penn State, and the Culture of Silence. Bill Mushi, I'd like to start with you. Did you accomplish what you hoped to with this book, Game Over, which is the first to be published about Jerry Sandusky, William Morrow HarperCollins book, and was it truly a culture of silence?
Well, first of all, what we sought out to do is to connect the dots on what happened both in the administrative part of Penn State and also in the athletic department, because most of the stories that have been done, there have been a lot of good journalism, but no one really did a story where they connect, or a book where they connected dots. And what it did was show that over 12 years, numerous people could have stopped this, at least the allegations against Jerry Sandusky, and they didn't. And from our point of view in the book, one of the contributions to that is this culture of silence, and Bob's the best describer of that. Go ahead, Bob.
Well, I think what Game Over is a cautionary tale for every college administrator, a must-read, because once you create your own little world and surround yourself in around walls that keep everything in, that you almost create an environment that allows this stuff to breed. So, yes, I think what we wanted to do was, more than anything else, to tell a story that was necessary, and this was the perfect time before the trial is scheduled in June, and a gag order has already been imposed.
And were you able to get all of your research done that you needed for this book prior to the gag order?
Well, to be honest, this is one of the most difficult writing assignments that Bill and I have ever been involved in. I've had 44 years in journalism, and Bill is close to that. We've had doors slammed in our faces and phones hung up. It's a very hostile, toxic environment at Penn State when this scandal erupted, and they just did not like the anyone shining the light on this insular culture, but yet we were able to find enough sources to put together the first and most complete narrative of what is really the worst scandal in college football history. We couldn't take no for an answer, and that's how we ended up here.
Well, exactly. And Bob, in your 44 years working in journalism, is it true that you're writing this book was as emotionally demanding as when you were on the battlefield and as an embedded reporter for the Associated Press during the 1990 Persian Gulf War, surrounded by landmines?
Actually, this was emotionally almost very similar. Department of Defense could take lessons from Penn State on how to contain information. It was it was that bad. I think one of the things you take away from Game Over is how isolated Penn State is. Geographically, it's in the middle of a valley, in the middle of the state, in the middle of nowhere. And isolation is one of its charms, but isolation also contributed to what happened. And it wasn't just geographic. It was that culture of Happy Valley surrounded by the mountain ridges and people living in this this world that they just didn't like outsiders to come into.
Well, we also know that this book, you gave up your holidays, Christmas with families, birthdays, just nonstop to write this. Could you share a little bit about the massive complications you both found developing this story?
Well, the idea of it was the most difficult reporting process we've ever been through, and you know, we thought that once the early stages of the case was over, there was enough information out there to build a narrative about how this could have happened over a 12-year period, and that's what our goal was. It was toxic, but we did manage to find over 100 people that talked to us, and we were able to put together the story about what is basically a cautionary tale for every college administrator or any company that has a small or a contained environment, because, you know, when people live in these cocoons, sometimes they rot from the inside out, and in this situation, there were so many people who had so many opportunities to at least vet these accusations that were being made dating back to 1998 that when you look at it from a timeline point of view, you sort of sit back and shake your head.
Well, Nancy and Lisa, I mean, from mid-November on, it's just been a blur for me, and I think I speak for Bill as well, because this is the type of story that you have to almost immerse yourself in and live it. I can remember 20-hour days and, you know, burning the midnight oil and then getting up early to write. You know, and not only was the writing tough from a deadline standpoint, but we also did some original reporting that, you know, the guts of this story is our on-the-ground efforts to penetrate this culture of silence. And so you think about a Thanksgiving that's lost, and my birthday's Christmas Eve, so I turned 62,
that's a cool day,
but that was just another day. And Christmas, New Year's, and even on into Easter, it was it's been that kind of an intense experience. And you know, when I talk about the intensity of being on a battlefield in Iraq with the 82nd Airborne, the intensity here actually lasted longer. And I think that week between Christmas and New Year's was when most of the people we wanted to talk to had shut it down for the holidays, and there was nobody around, and you just got this terrible gnawing feeling that, you know, when you get down and start plumbing the depths of the nature of these charges and how long they went on, it takes hold of you emotionally, and you have to sort of marinate in those kinds of feelings and the raw emotion that this thing generated. I don't think you can help but being changed by something of this nature.
Now, do you know who broke open the Jerry Sandusky case, and how did it happen?
Yeah, it was broken by a young lady. She's 24 years old, named Sarah Ganim from the Harrisburg Patriot News. It's an interesting story. She started out working for the paper in State College and then moved over to the Patriot News, and she broke the story back in March of 2010, I think it was. And
last year, Bill.
2011, I'm sorry. And she won the Pulitzer Prize for her work.
Wow, amazing. Well, Bob, what kinds of tricks did you resort to get people to talk to you?
I used every trick I learned in 44 years. You know, it's persistence, really, is just to... people have asked me, how did you get people to talk? And the simple answer is, I asked them. For everybody who said no, it makes you just more determined. You know, I called former players. I talked to former assistant coaches at Penn State. I talked to investigators. I talked to anybody I thought that was connected to this case that might be able to shed some light on it. Then once you get one person to talk, well, then maybe you can move on to the next person and the next person and the next person. And as Bill said, we did get more than 100 interviews in this. And being on the ground in State College, and because Penn State is a flagship university of Pennsylvania, it was like all four corners of the state. So it was sometimes charm, sometimes badgering, sometimes just people getting sick of being called up and deciding this, well, if I'm not going to get rid of you, I guess I'm going to have to talk to you.
And you can say that times two.
Oh, right. Now, could you just share with us about Joe Leiter, the State Patrol officer who got the entire thing started all by himself?
Right, and you say, well, what was the key to our cracking the story and being able to see how the investigation unfolded? There had been investigations twice on the Penn State campus that didn't get beyond the boundaries of State College, that those were self-contained. In 2009, there was a complaint lodged against Jerry Sandusky, who by this time had been banned from the Penn State campus but was serving as a volunteer coach in Central Mountain, a rural area north of State College. The complaint was lodged by a mother who saw her son break down in school. She alerted authorities, and the case was too hot for them to handle. It got kicked to the state level, where there's a statewide grand jury that's set up to handle these kinds of things. The attorney general at the time is Tom Corbett, who is now governor. He assigned one lone state trooper to the case, happened to be Joe Leiter. He looked into the allegation. Then he picked up, of all things, to find out more about Jerry Sandusky, picked up a copy of his autobiography, which is called Touched. And in that text, book, are first names and pictures of some of his favorite kids from the Second Mile. Now, if you and I read it, I don't think it would make much of an impression on us, but as a seasoned investigator, he was able to match first names to last names, then look up addresses and start knocking on doors. And lo and behold, it's as simple as it sounds, gumshoe detective work, knocking on doors and finding names, but that was exactly what this case needed. The first person outside of Penn State to look at it knocked on a door, a young man answers, he asked him about the Second Mile and Jerry Sandusky, and the young man says, how did you find me?
Wow.
Jerry Sandusky's own words drew a roadmap back to the investigators, and it speaks to one of the, I don't know, that's when the light went on for me, sort of like this epiphany, like, oh my, this is how he went about his business, and we were able from that point on to document how the case unfolded.
What did you think when Joe Paterno passed away?
You know what, and here's another thing. When I talked about being on the ground, I was in State College that weekend, and I happened to be standing at the statue of Joe Paterno at Beaver Stadium, the football stadium in State College, on that Sunday morning, after a 7-inch snowstorm, by the way, and when the official word came down that he had passed away because he had taken a turn for the worse the night before. And mm-hmm. It was as if people just started to materialize and start putting mementos at the bottom of the statue in honor of Joe. So it was a passing of a great man, a great coach, someone who had meant so much to State College and Penn State because of his contributions to the library and contributions to athletics. And yet, you know, we've said this, no coach in America has ever been more exalted, and for good reason, but no coach has ever fallen so fast. It was like the tragedy of a Shakespearean proportion.
He went
from Lion King. Yes. He went from Lion King to King Lear in a matter of days, and then passed away from lung cancer. So it was it's just almost hard to describe, but this just outpouring of emotion for Joe Paterno.
But you think they were right in firing him?
You know what? When he tried to resign, he said he was going to resign, and he told the Board of Trustees, don't spend a single moment more worrying about me. You have more important things to do. And lo and behold, 12 hours later, he was fired. at late at night over the phone after 61 years at the university. Now, you'd say, well, did he deserve it? I think deserve had nothing to do with it, because when you think of it, did the 10 young men who came forward with their stories of abuse deserve what they got, too? Which also speaks to the tremendous raw emotion that just oozed out from this whole scandal.
It's amazing. Now, have you ever met these men in person?
I actually, back in the day of old-fashioned journalism, there was a term that used to be called a swing person, someone who covered news because they were good at it, but someone with a an affinity for sports, and would cover sports. So I would I had my foot probably in both arenas. I met Joe several times. One, when there was a TV movie called Something for Joey, John Cappelletti's Heisman dedication to his dying brother, and there was an on-campus premiere there. So I had met Joe, and I was actually covering the Sugar Bowl in 1983 when Penn State won its first national championship. I may have in my life covered a half a dozen to 10 Penn State football games, so I knew Joe. Not to say we were friends or anything, but I had met him, and I actually have a Penn State connection. I went to Penn State for my first 2 years of college, so I sort of I had a working knowledge of the campus, I had a working knowledge of the culture, and I had a working knowledge of some of the key figures involved here, which was, I would say, Bill, wouldn't you, invaluable in cracking this culture of silence?
It was, certainly was. But the culture of silence is a very unique situation, and the way we look at our book is a very much of a cautionary tale to others, because, Jesus, when you see all of the opportunities people had over there, I keep hearkening back to that, because from 1998 on, at least, there were several individuals on that campus that knew about the allegations, and they did nothing. And when you read the hard, cold words of the presentment, it shows that many additional kids are alleging horrible abuse, despite the fact that people knew about it or knew about the allegations for 12 years.
Well, what length did Penn State go to cover up the details, do you think?
Well, you know, in 1998, a woman called and demanded that her husband, that her Jerry Sandusky, be arrested because he had showered with her son naked in the Penn State locker room showers. And the Penn State police conducted an investigation. At one point, the Pennsylvania Department of Public Welfare got involved. And in our reporting, we learned that the welfare folks do not believe the Penn State police were honest and forthright with all the information they had. They abruptly ended the investigation even after they hid in a closet while the mother was talking to Sandusky, and during the conversation when the mother confronted him about the abuse, Sandusky uttered the words, "I wish I were dead." The public welfare people never knew of that and ended up ending their investigation almost concurrently. And then there was another event in 2002 where an assistant coach told Joe Paterno that he saw Ms. Sandusky abusing a kid in the shower again, and that went all the way up through the structure and did not even get reported to police. Mr. Paterno didn't report it above him for a couple of days, and then the guy who made the original report didn't even get questioned for 9 days. And to this day, we're not aware of any effort that anybody at the university made to even determine the identity of the young child involved.
Wow. Well, can you give us an idea about what happened in the days mentioned in your book, Game Over, discussing especially the 10 days that shook Happy Valley until the day they fired Joe Paterno?
that was one of the most emotionally gut-wrenching periods of time that even if you were the biggest critic of Penn State, and you wouldn't wish this on your worst enemy, because it begins on a Saturday. I remember being home, you sit in the easy chair and you're watching the TV and maybe catch up on a couple of scores or whatever it is, and word breaks that Jerry Sandusky of Penn State has been arrested and charged with this volume of crimes involving child molestation. And you sit there and say, oh, that can't be. There's shock and disbelief. And then it plays over and over and over again. And lo and behold, it's true. And then from that point on, from that Saturday, for the 10 days after, it was a period where Happy Valley just ceased to exist, because that whole illusion of Penn State being a place where it was a squeaky clean program and nothing ever went wrong, and it was all about the school, well, all of that just went right out the window. And the university's reaction to the arrest was so badly handled, it was like for the first time they couldn't control their own message, and they got blindsided by it. I will say, I think the news cycle that's set up 24/7 now with instant communication, the Twitters and the bloggers and everything else, bang, it just took off. And by the time students got back to school on Monday, I mean, students aren't aware, they don't follow these things. They didn't know, but they're all of a sudden inundated with media and TV satellite trucks, and everybody's looking for reaction. Joe Paterno had put out a statement on Sunday, which still rings in our ears, and I think you would find this to be true also, the resonation of this, where he says, with the benefit of hindsight, I wish I would have done more. And we still don't know what he would have done and why didn't he do it. But as this thing snowballs, nobody at Penn State is standing up and addressing this issue and talking about these missed opportunities. The pressure builds. Joe feels it and announces, I mean, this is blockbuster, that he's going to resign after 61 years at the university, but he wants to finish out the season and coach his final three games so he'd get the send-off that he thought he deserved. Well, then he got fired late at night, which touches off this, anger amongst the students, and they take to the streets, and there's a, for lack of a better word, a riot. And what happens is there's so much resentment against the media who's descended on campus that the first thing they do is turn over a TV truck, a symbol of the media, and set it on fire. Then sanity gets, Penn State struggles for its soul, and all of a sudden, they start to remember the essence of this, which are the young men who came forward with these tales. So now there's candlelight vigils for the young men, and a change of coach, and there's a game coming up, and you got to get prepared for that. Candlelight vigils at night, and the two teams who were involved in the Saturday game, Penn State and Nebraska, opponents on a football field, get together at midfield and hold hands in prayer, and get a sense that this was starting to and maybe have some healing and moving forward. You get into the next day, the Sunday talk shows, and it's all over now. I mean, Penn State, the lead story on the network news, it was just unbelievable. And finally, the Big Ten Conference, of which Penn State is a member, announces that it's going to remove Joe Paterno's name from its championship trophy, which is, as I wrote, akin to the ancient pharaohs. Once the successor would chisel off the name of his predecessor as if he didn't even exist anymore. And in the backdrop of all this, Bill and I were able to get some background information on what was going through the minds of Penn State administrators who were faced with this crisis but yet couldn't handle it, in the thinking behind the scenes of having to do something but not knowing exactly what to do, and fumbling it badly. And then it's like it was over. It was the end of Happy Valley as we knew it.
Well, it's just amazing, and we're hoping that the case for Jerry Sandusky won't fall apart.
Well, here's the, you know, we were talking about Joe. I if you want to talk about Jerry Sandusky for a second, you know, he's from Western Pennsylvania, hotbed of football. He went to Penn State, returns as a coach. If you were to draw up on a blackboard the portrait of the pillar of the community, you start with a sports legend who founds a charity with a biblical name recognized by George Bush as one of his thousand points of light, the male Mother Teresa of Central Pennsylvania, joined at the hip to a prestigious university, and then all of a sudden that public image of being just, you know, the perfect male role model, with the allegations that are brought against him, it just incomprehensible, almost unfathomable that could happen. So I think, as you know, tragedies don't happen to small people, but this was epic in its proportions.
And then when you read the grand jury materials, it shows that the people around him were in abject disbelief early on in this whole process. I don't know how you could be in disbelief when it's a second accusation, but they would like say things like that he was horsing around with a kid in the shower, despite the fact that they were naked, or just be apologists. In Sandusky's own book, Touched, he calls himself the Great Pretender. And now he's facing 52 charges from 10 young men, and also there's another handful of people who observed him around with young men in the showers, etc. So even his own lawyer said the defense of this case is like a trek up the side of a mountain. And you know, it's supposed to go to trial in June, and that's when we're going to see the people who accuse Sandusky stare him down and tell their story, and then face cross-examination.
In the 80 years combined experience that Bill and I have in covering stories and trials and legal proceedings, you never see a case with this many people coming forward beating the same drum and coming up with the same story and same allegation, and how they were picked out from this charity and groomed and then went through this process. You just don't see that weight and volume of allegation that's brought without ever seeing either at least a plea bargain or a conviction. So that's our
job. There's I've covered trials for many years, and there's a mountain of evidence, and most child abuse cases are he said, she said stories where one person says somebody did something, and then it becomes a credibility issue. And, you know, I'm sure that Sandusky's defense team is preparing a scathing cross-examination against every one of them, because one of the weaknesses of the case is that a lot of times and dates and places are not there, because the kids say they don't remember the exact times, dates, and places. Some of them do, because they were at specific places, but so that's an issue in the case. But, I mean, it's not going to be easy. Bob and I wrote a piece in the Huffington Post about the idea that a lot of folks believe that when a victim of child abuse has to testify against their alleged abuser, it constitutes another set of abuse.
Gentlemen, this has been quite the honor to have you on, and we ran out of time, but we want to have you back on again. Would you guys come back on again? Because there's so much to talk about with this case.
Yeah, sure, anytime you want.
We would love that.
Okay, yeah. Absolutely, sure.
And we have a link on our website for everyone to find you, and again, the book is Game Over, Jerry Sandusky, Penn State, and the Culture of Silence, published by William Morrow, HarperCollins. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Have a nice weekend.
Thank you for having us.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye-bye.
Well, our prayers go out to all of the victims and families, and Our hearts just break for this situation. Well, we're thanking our sponsor, St. Croix Orthopedics. If you're interested in advertising on Chit Chat Cafe Live, contact us, chitchatcafelive@yahoo.com. We're also thanking Corey King, our producer. Tune in to The Corey King Show every Wednesday night, 7 p.m. on Artist First.
And then we'd like to thank our guests, Jimmy Dillon and Bob and Bill, that were just on our show talking about Jerry Sandusky. And if you want to listen to any of our previous shows, just go to our website, scroll down to the show you'd like to listen to, click it on the date, and you can listen to our archives and enjoy some of our past shows.
Well, good night, everyone.
Good night. I know you've been shot down, but that's all.